Let's continue from where we were last time. So today I want to discuss a little more about the geometry of Twister space. So Twister space, so it has its complex manifold with two patches. Say U with coordinates V1, V2, Z, and U tilde, which has coordinates V1 tilde, V2 tilde, Z tilde, and on the locus, when Z is not equal to 0, in U, and Z tilde is not equal to 0, in U tilde, we can glue them together. Following rule, V1 becomes V1 tilde over Z tilde. So this means that V1 has a pole at Z equals infinity, or Z tilde equals 0. Similarly for V2, and Z becomes 1 over Z tilde. Okay, we were trying to figure out the following statement. I'll give you kind of the coordinate proof, and then I'll discuss an abstract proof. So the statement was that the vector fields on Twister space, which exist on all of Twister space and have no poles, those are exactly the conformal transformations of spacetime. Position PD So in order to figure this out, I actually said something a little not quite correct last time. I got the Jacobian transformation wrong. But in order to figure this out, we need to figure, you know, I can write a vector field in the path U, and then if I go to the other patch, it'll become some other vector field, and I have to calculate that transformation. And, you know, we know how to do this from elementary calculus. We use the Jacobian matrix with this coordinate change and calculate. So if we do this calculation, we find that vector fields transform as del z goes to minus z tilde squared del z tilde. This is what we saw for CP1, so that this transformation at z equals infinity has a 0 in this part. But if you work out the transformation, because of the presence of z tilde in the v pieces, there's another term. And the other term looks like this. And vi goes to z tilde. OK, so now it's a kind of tedious exercise to figure out if I have a vector field, and then on one patch, if I take something like f del z plus gi del v tilde I, so del vi, and I bring it, we move to the other patch. And if when we move to the other patch, it has no poles, So that's some constraint on these coefficient functions. And then you just calculate what are the possibilities. So this is what this constrains. F g I. So what are the, I'll write out the possible solutions over here. So firstly, there's the four translations. These are del vi and z del vi. So what's the point? If I go to the other patch, this guy acquires a z tilde, so that's totally fine. It doesn't have a pole. And this z becomes 1 over z tilde in the other patch and cancels that. So that's also totally fine. It doesn't have a pole. Now, the second thing is going to be 6 equals 3 plus 3 rotations. So we have the Lorentz group is 6-dimensional. And of course, it lives in the conformal group. So let's write down these guys. What are they? There's, I can take A I J V I del V J, where trace of this matrix vanishes. This gives me 3 of the rotations. So the other 3 are given by del z. Z del z plus vi del vi and z squared del z plus z vi del vi. So this is basically the same as what we saw in CP1, the conformal transformations of CP1, except I have to add on this extra term, especially here, because this extra term is needed. If I had a z squared here, it would become a 1 over z tilde over here. And that's fine here, but and this term would give a pole. So I need something, I need to add on something like this to cancel that. And that's why we need that extra term. And finally, well, there's the dilation operator. That's just vi del vi. And finally, there's going to be 4 special conformal transformations. Which are vi del z and vi times z del z plus vj del vj. So there's 2 of them, and there's the other 2. And you know, it's some little piece of algebra to check that this is all there is. And I hope since you've done a unit on conformal field theory, right? So you guys should be familiar that the fact that the conformal group looks like this. Okay. So what have we learned from this? So let's try to recast it in a little more conceptual way. Well, I think the thing that's we're going to really understand how to think about twister space is if we understand the rotations. So Do you guys remember? If I take the group spin 4, this is the group of rotations of Euclidean space. This can be rewritten as SU2 times SU2. Well, if I use complex coefficients, that's SL2C times SL2C. So in twister space, one copy of SL2C rotates the VI, and the other acts as conformal transformations on the CP1 with coordinate z. This observation is kind of going to be interesting, maybe much later, maybe at some point we won't get to in this course, in that people who study celestial holography like to think about scattering amplitudes of four-dimensional field theories, which are all about this symmetry, as related to a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And we're kind of seeing a hint about this here, that the Lorentz group, or part of it, acts as conformal symmetries on a two-dimensional sphere. So are there any questions about this discussion so far? So, and just for your general knowledge, I really hope you guys are familiar with this fact, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do we see the action of SL2C on the VIs? What is the action?
Oh, well, I kind of wrote it here, right? I said we have 6, which is this six-dimensional group, equals 3 plus 3 rotations, and this is the 3, this is the other 3. So the first 3 are given by these vector fields. So A is a trace-free matrix, so A is an element of SL2, the algebra, Lie algebra. And it just wrote, these vector fields are the ones which rotate the V's. And then the other ones are the conformal transformations.
Related to the V's and the Z.
Yeah.
So normally I would think of twister space as like a fiber of S2 over Minkowski space.
That's a very Euclidean picture, but that, yes.
So if we think in terms of that, then can we think that the VIs are basically spinners of?
Yes. Well, you see the fact, we do see that there's spinners here because this spin representation of spin 4, it has 2 spin representations, and they're the fundamental representations of each of these 2 copies of SL2. Now, the VIs transform in the fundamental representation of one of them, therefore they're spinners. The other one, this CP1, it's acted on by this SL2, so that CP1 should be thought of as the projectivization of the other spin representation.
And the information about space-time is hidden in Z.
Yes, I was going to get to that later today, so the how to reconstruct space-time from Twister space. So we'll get to that point later. Okay, so this was a little cumbersome. So we can ask, you know, is there some pure thought way to figure out that the transformations of Twister space are the conformal transformations of space-time? So to do that, I want to explain something I mentioned briefly last time, that Twister space is almost the same as CP3. CP3 is the set of vectors like this, U1, U2, U3, U4, UI not all zero, up to you identify them when we can rescale the vector. So Twister space is the subset given by the same collection of vectors where U3, you're going to have a stronger constraint. Instead of asking that one of the four components is not zero, I want to ask that one of the last two is not zero. So this has the effect of removing the locus where U3, U4 equals zero, and that locus is a CP1. So Twister space is CP3 with a certain CP1 removed. So how do we go from this picture to the other coordinate picture? Well, if we look at this description, there's two patches. There's the patch where U4 is not zero, and then there's the patch where U3 is not zero. So they're not both zero, so one of them is non-zero.
Sorry, wouldn't it be U1 and U2 not zero instead? U3 and U4, I thought were non-zero by definition of the set.
Sorry, not both zero. Not both zero at the same time. So I say U is the set where, say, U3 is not equal to 0. And then U tilde is the set where U4 is not equal to 0. So by scaling on U, we can rescale to be like this. U1, U2, 1, U4. And I want to identify this with my previous coordinates. So I'm going to set this equal to V1, V2, 1, z. And on U tilde, we have U1, U2, U3, 1. This I want to identify with V1 tilde, V2 tilde, z tilde, 1. So the intersection is the set where they're both non-zero. So on the intersection, Well, that's where z is not equal to 0, and z tilde is not equal to 0. We're going to go from one expression to the other by dividing by z, or dividing by z tilde. So this factor is equivalent to, which is the koans, I keep forgetting, v1 over z, v2 over z, 1 over z, 1. And this is then v1 tilde, v2 tilde, z tilde, 1. So we found the transformation we had before. Z tilde is 1 over z, and vi tilde is vi over z, as before. Okay, so this is a more global picture of twister space. It's an open subset of CV3. OK, so how does this help us? I wanted to figure out the symmetries. And CP3, you know, it's basically this built from vectors in C4. And if I have a vector, there's an obvious symmetry. I can just hit it with a matrix. So the group SL4C acts on CP3 by sending U4 to display, just hit it with a matrix. SL4C, which remember is the 4x4 complex matrices. With determinant equals 1. You might ask, why do I ask impose determinant equals 1? The reason is, you know, any multiple of the identity matrix doesn't do anything just by construction, because that just rescales my vector. And that's, you know, in the same equivalence class. OK, so well, this is good because SL4C, the dimension of this group is, well, 4x4 matrices is a dimension 16. And I'm asking the determinant is 1, so that's 15 dimensional. That's promising because there are 15 conformal transformations. And you can actually check that this is the same as these 15 transformations over here. This is the conformal group. Well, complexified in 4 dimensions. OK, so I want to explain this a little more detail in a second, but do you guys, you know, if I ask you what the conformal group is in 4 dimensions, would you be able to tell me the answer from ADS CFT course? Or?
It depends on signature, but SO6 of different kinds.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, so in Euclidean signature, it's SO51. And in Lorentzian, it's SO42. But because we're complexifying, it actually doesn't really matter. So what we're using here is another one of these funny isomorphisms of Lie groups. Here we saw spin 4 is actually not a new group. It's a product of two groups we already knew. And there's a similar relationship that SL4 and SO6 are the same thing. So the following fact. SL for C is equal to spin 6C. Which is the double cover of SO6C, and this is the 6x6 complex matrices say M with M transpose equals the identity. This is one of these weird coincidences of Lie groups. So the fancy way to prove this is to go to use the classification of Lie groups and look at the Dynkin diagrams of these guys and see that they're the same. But there's a, for all of these things, there's also some really kind of concrete and down-to-earth way to see it. So the concrete way to see this is if V is the vector rep of SL4, then the exterior square of V, that is the anti-symmetric tensors, is of dimension 6. So it has a basis, Vi wedge Vj, or I less than j, is a basis, so there's 6 elements. And it also has an inner product. So you can define the inner product of two elements of the exterior square in this way by using the epsilon tensor. And the only thing I've used, those matrices which preserve the epsilon tensor are those matrices of determinant 1. So the group SL4 preserves this inner product. So that's good because SO6 is the symmetries of a six-dimensional vector space with an inner product. And we're saying that SL4 does act on a six-dimensional vector space, preserving the inner product. So we get a map, SL4C to SO6C, which is a double cover. And this is why this is the spin group.
Using like a joint representation, or
Why do we need an inner product?
No, why is that an inner product of that space?
On the space wedge 2V, it takes two elements of the space and gives you a number, and it's bilinear and symmetric. It's symmetric because if I switch the first pair with the last pair. So that's, you just have to check it's non-degenerate. And then you see it's an inner product.
So the space of two forms on SL4C takes me from a vector in SL4C to some point in six dimensional space. Is that?
I wouldn't say I take a vector, because if I take a vector, how would I get an element of wedge 2? Because V wedge V is 0, because it's anti-symmetric. So rather, it's this is just a six-dimensional, you know, if I give my group SL4, it has a bunch of representations, and this is one of them.
Yeah. So I suppose we could act with an element, one 4x4 matrix, which, yeah, with determinant 1. Yeah, 4x4? No, 2-bit. Yeah,
four, mm-hmm.
We would act on each one of the V's and the bases,
mm-hmm.
And somehow we would take the and it would preserve the inner product. These matrices preserve the
epsilon tensor because they're determinant one, or at the infinitesimal level they'd be trace free.
And since we use two of them, we can map. We can use plus or minus the same matrix. We use two because we transform to V.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Like, so the identity and minus the identity get sent to the same thing.
Yeah.
That's why it's a double cover, because there's two V's, exactly. And the converse is spin 6C has a four-dimensional spin representation. So if I use the gamma matrices to represent these elements of spin 6 as 4x4 matrices, that gives me a map. And this map is an isomorphism. And if you want to check it's an isomorphism, if I have two Lie groups of the same dimension and I have a map between them, which is not constant, then it's either an isomorphism or a cover.
Can you explain this more? Like, the gamma matrices are the generators of CL6, and they map me from spin 6 to SL4C?
Yeah, so the gamma matrix, if I take A as an index for SO6C, and I take, say, I don't know, alpha, which runs from 1 to 4 as a spinner index, then we have these gamma matrices. So this is a map SO6C to SL4C, which sends an element like this. TA gets sent to gamma A alpha beta. And this is a 4x4 matrix. So what we've seen is that the symmetries of twister space are the conformal symmetries of spacetime. But we haven't really seen how, if you give me a point on spacetime, what kind of object on twister space does that correspond to? So the basics. So let me explain that, which is the kind of basics of the twister correspondence. Point P in C4, which is complexified spacetime, gets sent, corresponds to a copy of CP1 in twister space, which deforms the line where v1 equals 0, v2 equals 0. So basically, this point, or this CP1, where v1 and v2 are 0, that's the origin in spacetime. And if I move away from the origin, I'm going to be changing these equations to some other equations, cutting out some other pair of equations, cutting out a one-dimensional region in twister space. And the other part of the correspondence is, so P, Q in C4 are like separated if and only if these CP1s, CP1, Q, intersect. Okay, I'll write at it to make this more explicit in a second, but let's so we notice twister space is three complex dimensional. So your intuition from three-real dimensional geometry is pretty good. Now, we should think CP1, this is like a one complex dimensional thing. So this is analogous to like a line in R3. It's like a line in three-dimensional geometry. If I take two lines, generically they don't intersect. It's a non-trivial equation on their positions that they intersect. So it's kind of reasonable that, if I take two points in spacetime, generically they're not like separated. So it's plausible that this is some non-trivial equation, and then we'll compute that it is indeed that these are equivalent. So how does this go? So if we deform the equations V1 equals 0, V2 equals 0. There's some technical detail I'm going to kind of skip over a little bit here, but the only way to do this, which works well on the other patch, is to take a linear equation. V1 is a plus b times z, and v2 equals c plus d times z. Well, let me just briefly mention why this is a reasonable thing to do. So as z goes to infinity, this piece has a pole, and this piece has a pole too, first order pole. So it's kind of reasonable that both sides of a first order pole. In other words, if we go to the other patch, this will become the tilde 1 over z tilde z tilde, or equivalently, V1 tilde, z tilde a plus b, c tilde c plus d. So on the other patch, the equation looks the same. So that's good. This is a nice equation. So now, well, we've kind of sketched the nice deformations of the locus where v1 and v2 equals 0. There's four parameters. These four parameters are going to correspond to the points of spacetime. These are going to be coordinates on C4. Well, what about the metric? So I wanted to say that two points are light-like separated if the corresponding CP1s intersect. So that should mean this vector A, B, C, D is null if and only if the locus where V1 is A plus BC, V2 equals C plus D, DZ intersects the locus where V1 equals 0 and V2 equals 0. So how can that happen? Well, and basically, if they intersect, then that means there's some value of z for which the left-hand side is 0. So their intersection is they intersect if a certain linear equation can be solved. Now, we know the condition for solving a linear equation. It's when the determinant of this matrix vanishes.
This cannot happen if we complexify Euclidean space.
Yes, we can, because when we complexify Euclidean spacetime, we're going to be using the complex valued metric. And then you can still have null lines, but it'll just have imaginary coefficients. So the Euclidean metric is, dxi squared. So we can solve the equation sum xi squared equals 0 be solved with if the xi are complex, e.g. the vector I 1 0 0 solves this equation. So later, we're going to try to figure out if I want to look at actual spacetime and not complexified spacetime, I want to have some other constraint on these curves. And then if you choose that constraint to correspond to Euclidean signature, you'll find exactly what you said.
So just so quickly, because I wasn't able to understand. So we're trying to establish a correspondence between points and complexified spacetime. And a copy of CP1 inside, for every copy inside of Twister space. Okay, so somehow this, we were studying the formations of lines. So we set V1 equal to 0 and V2 equal to 0.
That's the origin.
Okay.
So I'm going to change that equation. I'm going to change it to this.
And it can only be changed linearly because it's, we said that's the only way it can be made global in some sense, or?
Yeah, because suppose I had a quadratic equation, like v1 is a plus bz squared. Then if I go to the other patch, I get v1 tilde over z tilde equals a plus b over z tilde squared. I bring this over, v1 tilde, a z tilde, plus b over z tilde, and then it goes off to infinity.
At z equal to 0.
Z tilde equals 0, yes.
Okay, so it's the only way to make the function, well, yeah, holomorphic globally. And then, so we set these to 0 now. Okay, so we're saying...
let me draw a picture. I'm not going to draw it in 3 dimensions. We'll draw it in 2 dimensions because I can't draw it. You know, we have a line given by some equation. It looks exactly like this, except in 3 dimensions.
Which would be the equations here?
These equations.
Okay.
But it, you know, yes, in 3rd dimension, and I'm imposing 2 equations, and the solution set is some line like this.
Yeah.
And then I ask, what are the conditions on these coefficients that it intersects some other line, maybe the axis, one of the axes. And that's 2 equations on the coefficients of this line. Sorry, not 2 equations, 1 equation.
And what would be the second equation right now? The one would be through, no. There's something I'm failing to grasp. What would be the second equation? The one with the x in this example, an analogy to this?
So what's the equation? So I have this line, and let's just think of everything is real.
Yeah.
Taking pictures.
There are 2 coordinates here, and z is some parameter, and now this whole
thing. No, the 3 coordinates are v1, v2, and z. I have a 3-dimensional space,
okay.
Coordinates v1, v2, and z. And in this 3-dimensional space, I have a linear equation cutting out a line. Like, when does this line intersect the axis, the z-axis?
Okay.
And that's a condition on these coefficients that when I set the left-hand side to 0, I can find z solving that pair of equations.
Okay.
So that's the condition that the determinant of that matrix vanishes.
Okay. Fair enough.
What do we mean by coordinates on C4 are null? Because a consupports different signatures, right?
Yeah, so you're right. I should have clarified that point. Thank you. So, give C4 coordinates, say x1 up to x4. But these are complex. Maybe should I call them something else? I'm calling them w1, so they won't be confused by real coordinates. And then the length of a vector, we're not going to take a length which is real. We're going to take, because we're analytically continuing everything. So the length of a vector is going to be the complex number. Some wi squared. Now, if wi is equal to wi bar, so they're real, this is gives OR4 inside of C4, the Euclidean length. But we can make other choices. So if w1 is equal to minus w1 bar, so w1 is imaginary, but wi is wi bar for i 2, 3, 4, this gives the Lorentzian length. So we have this analytically continued spacetime, which when you choose reality condition, like some condition on your coordinates, you can pick out any signature you like. Is that the clarifier?
Yes. So when we say null here, to trying to develop the correspondence between the intersection, do we mean with respect to the Lorentzian length?
When we say null, we mean with respect to this complex length.
Oh, the whole thing is, yeah.
Yeah. But then later we want to say, you know, I really care about, say, Euclidean. I want to select this subset where the WIs are real. Like, what condition? That subset is going to impose some extra condition on my CP1s. And then, and once I impose those extra conditions, you'll find the Lorentzian or Euclidean metrics. So let's maybe, I was going to do that now, actually. So to get the Euclidean metric, from C4 with complex metric, AD minus BC, which we find from the determinant, well, you're going to have some condition to make this positive definite. So the condition is, that would happen if D is the complex conjugate of A, and C is minus the complex conjugate of B. So we'll get a constraint like this. If we define a way of complex conjugating the coordinates vi and z on twister space, so and then look at the CP1s that map to themselves. So, you know, you might, you know, if we work on just the on C, you might think we can just complex conjugate by sending Z to Z bar. But if you're working on a more global complex manifold, there's a bunch of different ways to do that. You know, on CP1, I could send Z to Z bar, or I could by, you know, but Z isn't really a God-given coordinate. There's other possible choices of coordinates. And if I worked in those coordinates, the transformations might look very different.
So I'm a bit confused still with the inner product that we have. Mm-hmm. Is it the mod square or just the square of the W's?
There's no complex conjugate in that inner product.
That could possibly be negative or zero.
Exactly. And it's or imaginary. Okay. It's not a normal length. It's a length taking values in the complex numbers.
Okay.
So for Euclidean signature, the complex conjugation operation sends z to minus 1 over z bar, and v1 to v2 bar over z bar, v2 to minus v1 bar over z bar. I'm writing down these formula. But again, it's one of these things that's kind of tightly constrained by asking that it behaves well on the other patch. And some of this is complex conjugation stuff is one of the most annoying things about twister theory, and I'd like to avoid it. I think it's worth mentioning here because working with this analytically continuous spacetime is kind of confusing, and I want to explain how we go back to an ordinary spacetime. So if I do this transformation, then if I look at the equations, this becomes v1 bar equals v2 bar over z bar equals a minus b over z bar minus v1 bar over z bar . So the real points values of A, B, C, D will be those for which both equations hold. I know this is a little complicated. The picture is the following. So I have a CP1. My complex conjugation does some kind of funny thing, which switches the north and south pole. Now, if my CP1 was kind of shifted off 0, then when I do this transformation, it might become a different CP1. But sometimes it becomes the same locus. And I'm looking for those values of A, B, C, and D where it is the same locus. And that's what that means both sets of equations hold. So how do we figure out if both sets of equations hold? I take this one, and I just complex conjugate it in the naive way. And I take this one, and So 2 implies V2 equals AZ minus B, V1 equals minus C plus minus CZ plus D, bar. This is just by complex conjugating and multiplying by Z. So if both sets of equations hold, we need looking here, V2, A bar equals D, and C bar equals minus B. So then, AD minus BC becomes A bar plus B bar, which is positive definite.
from the equation that we got, like we can see that we can only have that the two CP ones are the same or they are different, but that is because the transformation was linear, I think. Like, is there a geometric way to understand why they cannot, like, just intersect each other in one point or two? Or,
oh.
Like, not be the same?
Yeah, good question. Well, that's to do with, well, if I had, so that condition is somehow like if I take one CP1 and look at its transformation under this involution, that it becomes null separated, right? So I suppose it is possible. Yeah, I don't see why that can't happen, but I think it's just not the thing we want. Like, we have, there's a four complex dimensional family of curves. We want to pick out a four real dimensional family. So we want to get four real equations on these coefficients, and asking that is equal to its conjugate gives us those four real equations. So. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused about the geometric posture of this operation. So we start off by saying we want a metric, an Euclidean metric from AD minus BC.
Yes.
And so we find that those things have to hold, and that therefore the transformations on the V's must look like this.
Yes.
But then, so for the global picture, we have CP1, and then we have a copy of C2.
Yes.
Point.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly are we doing when we are requiring that the conjugations are
these, right. So what we're doing is we're writing down a map, I'll call it, say, rho, from twister space to itself. And this map is anti-holomorphic. Meaning that, you know, if I take a function here and pull it back, a holomorphic function becomes an anti-holomorphic function. And I also want that rho composed with rho as the identity. So people call this an anti-holomorphic involution. So geometrically, the map we're doing, well, let's see. So EG on CP3, we get such a rho by sending the coordinates to, say, their complex conjugates. And I think the one we write down is more or less the same as this, if you work it out in more explicitly, although I'll probably get the details wrong. From the picture of viewing twister space as a bundle, over CP1, on the base of the bundle, rho switches 0 to infinity, and it switches something here, something up there, because it sends z to minus 1 over z bar, and then it just does some transformation on the fibers too, some linear transformation. And now these CP1s are given by, for every fiber, I take a point, so it's something that looks like kind of cross section. And then there's an equation that when I switch this cross section, it doesn't become something else. It becomes the same thing. Yeah, maybe I can discuss it using the CP3 coordinates a little next time, because it might be more transparent.
I'm a bit stuck on why we've been using this dimension of a twister space? Is it because we want to arrive at a four-dimensional Minkowski, or like, is it generalizable?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It doesn't generalize really neatly. Something works in dimension three, but it's not as nice. And higher dimensions, people have tried to do stuff, but it's just not as clean. I'm not sure a really good reason why it doesn't work in other dimensions, except maybe one reason is we've used heavily these special isomorphisms of Lie groups, that SL4 is SL6. And those don't happen. You know, if you try to talk about the conformal group in five dimensions, it doesn't have a nice description as some matrices. So there's just some very special things about four-dimensional geometry.
So in some way, it's kind of just lucky that it's, or maybe not lucky, but that the math is so nice in the number of dimensions that corresponds to our...
Yeah, exactly.
Only if our scalar field is complex numbers.
That's it?
People have tried to find relation between SL2H being spin 5,1 and SL2O being spin 9,1.
Yes, that's true. But that's not as clean because you...
The notion of differentiation is not
exactly, yeah. So it's just harder. And you don't have such a good notion of holomorphicity anymore either. So
I have a question about complex space time, because like there are some things that we understand in Lorentzian signature and that are different in Euclidean signature. And I want to understand like the general case.
Mm-hmm.
Like for example, we've studied that like unitarity is reflection positivity for correlation functions.
Yes.
What is it for complex space then?
I don't know actually. There's an interesting recent paper of Konsevich and Segal, maybe about 2 years ago, where they study this question. For instance, they look at the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, and you want this to be positive. And then if I exponentiate that with e to the th, positivity tells me what regions in the complex plane I can allow t to be. So there's some kind of intricate story about unitarity and all that. I don't really understand it.